KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In the mid-40s, chance of rain this evening, then a chance of snow overnight, the low in the low 30s.
As a country, we have been through this too many times. Whether it's an elementary school in Newton or a shopping mall in Oregon or a temple in Wisconsin, or a movie theater in Aurora, or a street corner in Chicago. These neighborhoods are our neighborhoods, and these children are our children.
There will be the calls for better gun control laws. You know, there will be calls for better funding. And those that oppose those changes will just try to ride it out. And it's the duty of the people, and it's the duty of elected officials to keep the pressure on.
Mayor Mike McGinn, we'll be talking to him in a few moments, reacting to the shootings in Connecticut. President Obama as well. In Newtown, they're preparing to bury their dead after one of the country's worst mass shootings. The nation is still dealing with it, talking to each other. We were wondering what you're saying to your children as you're dropping them off to school, as you're heading off to school today. In the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to Seattle Schools security official. And then after that, we'd like to hear what you have to say. We'll take your calls. You can also email us weekday at kuow.org. We're putting some information on Facebook and on Twitter as well, so you can respond there. We'd like to hear what you're thinking about that. You've also heard that people are talking about gun control, some efforts to ban some of the military assault weapons, and people are looking at the way people are dealing with mental illness as well. I talked to Adam Winkler a few minutes ago. Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA. He studied the history of gun control and been one of the people writing about it for a long time. He wrote a book called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. It tracks the history of the right to bear arms, how it's evolved. He also looks at how the balance has been made with laws promoting gun safety over those years. I asked him, he's been doing a lot of interviews lately, so I asked him in all the interviews, what are people asking him? What do people want to know?
Well, people want to know what can we do, right? That's the biggest thing. What kinds of reforms can we do? People want to know about the Second Amendment, whether the Second Amendment imposes any major impediment to reform in this area. People want to know, what happened to the gun debate? Why did these incidents happen without any gun control laws being passed generally? Those seem to be the questions that get focused on.
The president came out and has made a few comments on that, and there is the sort of the first inklings of people trying to figure out just what does happen next. In the recent past, not much discussion has happened about gun control following these horrific events. It seems different this time to me. What about to you?
I think it is different. I think to see 20 children mercilessly slaughtered in a schoolroom is enough to change anyone's attitude about our gun control laws. I think that it takes, unfortunately, so many innocent lives to motivate people. But I also think that the political environment around gun control is changing. President Obama has avoided talking about gun control for 4 years because he was worried about reelection and appealing to swing state voters who love their guns. He no longer has that concern. And I think the November elections also showed that the NRA is not quite the political powerhouse that everyone's been making it out to be. Most of its endorsed candidates did not fare particularly well on Election Day. And after two elections of them saying Obama was coming to get everyone's guns, I think that they've lost a certain amount of credibility. Now is the time to act, and only now is the time to act. In 6 months' time, the political will for gun control will have faded pretty quickly, I think.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA. Among the things he studied is gun control history in America. Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America is his book. Well, what does that action look like to you?
Well, I think we need to see action in one of three areas, if not all three areas. One, we need, most importantly, to close the background check loophole. We currently only require background checks when you buy a gun from a federally licensed dealer, but you don't have to be a federally licensed dealer to sell a gun. As a result, about 40% of lawful gun sales occur with no background check whatsoever. That makes no sense whatsoever. We should have every single person who wants to buy a gun go through a background check. We should, number two, improve our mental health data reporting to that background check system. Currently, only about four states give all of their data about mental health adjudications to the federal government. Most states give less than a majority of mental health adjudication information to the federal government. We need to change that so that mentally ill people who are not allowed to have guns can't just go into a gun store and buy one. And we need to think about at least restrictions on high-capacity magazines and potentially even assault rifles. These are not self-defense weapons. You don't need 33 rounds of ammunition within a clip to defend yourself from a criminal. So we have to think seriously about whether limitations on the size of magazines or on particular kinds of especially dangerous weapons are worthwhile.
Now, you've looked at the history of gun control in America and how it's evolved and how the right to bear arms has evolved. Would any of these be outliers to the way the law has evolved and swung back and forth over the years?
Well, I don't know that they would be outliers. They would be extensions of current gun control laws. So we require background checks now as part of a 200-year history of banning people who we don't trust with guns from having them. The Founding Fathers had gun control laws and banned people who they didn't trust and thought were a threat to the public welfare from having guns. So requiring everyone to do a background check is just sort of a modern technological way of achieving the same goal, doing everything we can to keep the criminals and the mentally ill from getting their hands on guns. Assault weapons bans, they're of a piece with traditional restrictions on especially dangerous weapons. No one thinks that machine guns should be readily available for civilian self-defense, and perhaps we should apply that same rule to AR-15s and other assault rifles that really aren't very valuable for personal self-defense and are really just enjoyed by people as for hunting and sports shooting. Maybe that's not a good enough reason to have a gun in circulation because people like to shoot it at the gun range.
You know, you mentioned mental health data. Do we do enough decent collection of mental health data that it could be an effective tool across the country?
We do not do an effective job on that, and I think that one of the things that we need to think about outside of gun control is improving our mental health system. It's really been decimated over the last 30 years, lack of funding, lack of access to mental health care. The current federal background check system encourages states to give the federal government data on any person who is adjudicated to be mentally ill, a danger to themselves or others. That's a pretty limited range of people. You have to go into a court. You have to have a court determine that you're a danger to yourself and to others. That's going to only capture a very small fraction of people who are mentally ill. Perhaps we need to think about having a reporting system where when someone tries to sign up for the military, like Jared Lochner, and is turned away because he's thought to be unstable, or someone who goes to a school and is kicked out of school because they think he's not safe for the community, even without an adjudication of mental illness, that maybe that information goes into the federal background check system and at least raises a red flag and requires a more detailed, thorough investigation of the person before they buy a gun. We need to really think hard about our mental health data reporting for the gun system because it's very sorely lacking.
Would that raise some civil liberties questions for some advocates?
No doubt. Anytime we're dealing with mental health records, you run into civil liberties issues. We want to maintain the privacy of mental health records, but I think we need to have a balance here. How much privacy for mental health records do we want to secure if it means that people who are unstable, like a Jared Lochner, will be able to get their hands on firearms legally? I think that that's just a balance and a discussion that we have to have in our country. But no matter what, we definitely have to improve the reporting of adjudicated mental health issues. Where a court has said someone is mentally ill, there's no doubt that information has to be in the federal background check system. Today, it's just that system is very incomplete with regards to that data.
And Adam Winkler, would there be anything to block, other than politics, anything to block the ability to regulate high-capacity magazines or certain weapons? Is there anything in the laws in different states or at the federal level that would impede that, an effort to restrict those?
If there is any impediment, it's going to be the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court in 2008, in a case called District of Columbia against Heller, held that the Second Amendment does protect the right of individuals to have guns for self-defense. One thing they said is that the reason why handguns were a protected form of arm was because handguns are commonly used for self-defense. I've seen some in the gun rights community argue that high-capacity magazines and the so-called assault rifles like the AR-15, which are very popular firearms, are quote-unquote in common use. I think that's a misreading of what the Supreme Court said and a misreading of the Second Amendment. I think that the weapons have to be in common use for personal self-defense. Very few people, if any, use an AR-15 as a primary self-defense weapon in their home to protect from criminals. They're just far too dangerous for that.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA. We're taking a look at the consideration over gun control rights and gun rights ownership in the wake of the shootings in Connecticut. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times had an article over the weekend taking to task those people who say, look, this is about, you wouldn't be able to make any changes, people do crazy things, we can't control what crazy people do. And he went and looked at the statistics around the world in terms of places that have limited gun access. Also, argued that this is a public health issue and this is the way to approach this as a public health issue. And that would be the avenue by which you could create these restrictions and regulations. What do you think of that notion?
Well, I think that the Kristof article is really on to an essential truth, which is that while we may be motivated to act by these mass shootings, we should recognize that it's going to be very difficult to prevent future mass shootings. As long as there are so many guns in America, there's 300 million in circulation in the United States, as long as there's that many guns, madmen will be able to get their hands on guns somehow, some way, if they're determined enough, and do a lot of damage. But by focusing on guns as a public health issue, we can recognize that every day about 80 people lose their lives from gunshot wounds, a lot of them to suicide, a good number of them to homicide. We can reduce that number. And if we can reduce that number, 80 a day, even to 79 a day, then every month we'll save as many lives as were lost in the Shady Hook massacre. And that's where we can make a difference in gun policy.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at University of California, Los Angeles. He is the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Let's continue this question about gun control for a little bit more with Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, who joins us as he does every month to talk about some of the issues. Take your calls. Hello, sir.
Hello.
I heard what you had said last week about the clip we ran, the duty of the people to keep pressure for gun control on, if that's what they want to see occur. What can the city do? What can the mayor do to change gun control laws in our region?
Well, it's an interesting question because, you know, the prior mayor took an action to ban guns, for example, in parks and community centers and our pools. And what we found out that was litigated, and the state of Washington at the state legislature preempts any city from doing that. Now, you know, if we took that action, I'm not going to sit here and say that any one thing we do would be the thing that would solve this. But I look at, you know, something like we launched a road safety summit in which we're taking multiple actions to reduce the number of accidents we have on our streets. And there are a wide variety of things that could be done to change the culture of gun violence and gun use in this country if we chose to take that path. And we could change attitudes. And so that's, I think, why I spoke in part about the public, because learning, you know, between the combination of the cuts in funding for mental health that have occurred at the state level, we have more people with less support than ever before. And you combine that with a gun regulatory system, which is basically almost hands off on it. And what you have then is a recipe for this violence. I saw a this was a quote I saw this morning on the, you know, as I was reading, you know, one failed shoe bomb and we're all taking off our shoes at airports. 31 school shootings since Columbine. And, you know, we're not supposed to talk about the issue, really. And that's a culture issue. That's not a policy issue. I mean, if we have the will as a community, as a state, or as a nation to make a change, we can make a change. I'll point to another couple of things on the overall culture of an issue. You know, a decade ago, less than a decade ago, the Republicans were using gay marriage as a wedge issue to win elections. But our attitudes have changed. We just legalize marijuana use in the state of Washington, which will mean that, you know, thousands of lives, or if not more lives, will be improved because they won't be being sent away to jail for minor drug offenses. And we won't have violence that comes from, you know, low-level marijuana dealing or high-level marijuana dealing. And those are massive attitudinal changes. All of these are. Smoking. You know, we 20 years ago, maybe 30 years, I don't know what the date was, there'd be an ashtray between us, Steve. And both of us would be smoking cigarettes. And if either one of us said anything to the other about it, we'd be like, quit your whining. I'm allowed to smoke. When are we going to have this attitude towards guns, which are extraordinarily dangerous? We regulate ladders. We regulate baby cribs. We regulate toasters. You know, we regulate all sorts of products. Nicholas Kristof had a great article on this in the Sunday New York Times. You know, we regulate our streets to make them safer. When are we going to get serious about regulating guns? When are we going to have the type of culture shift that'll make a difference? And in that regard, probably the best thing that we can do right now is for people to speak up and make it a priority for their elected officials to change it. And not take silence or it's too hard or it's not politically realistic to do that as an answer. Because all of these things I was just talking about, it wasn't politically realistic to change gay marriage, pot legalization, smoking in rooms. Wasn't realistic to change any of those things once. Wasn't realistic to change any number of things in our history. If we want to change the culture of gun violence, it really starts with people demanding better. Now, in Seattle, that's easy to say because this city supports those changes, but we don't have the authority to do anything about it here.
Yeah. All right. Let me take a break on that. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about those issues and some other ones with the mayor. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
The National Weather Service has issued a high wind warning for much of western Washington until noon today. Right now in the U District, clouds and 44 degrees. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. Chance of rain this evening, then a chance of snow overnight, the low in the low 30s.
Support for KUOW comes from the Museum of History and Industry. Celebrating their grand opening at Lake Union Park, Mohai will feature special performances, activities, and programs December 29th through January 3rd. More information and a full schedule of events online at mohai.org.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. It's 9:23.
Mike McGinn is our guest. He's the mayor of Seattle. We're talking about a whole bunch of issues that we'll get up to in a minute, but I want to ask one more question about guns and gun safety and gun violence, but also about what we say to each other but to our children. So we're going to talk to the head of Seattle's security program supervisor for the – not Seattle. Program supervisor, the officer superintendent of public instruction safety center. So he deals with safety around the state. For schools. And we're going to ask folks afterwards, what are you saying to your children as you drop them off to school? But you said, and other people said, well, some recommendations are to say nothing to little kids.
I wait for my kids to raise it.
Your kids are older, right?
Yeah, I have a 13, 15, and 18-year-old. So I let them raise it, and we talk about it when it comes up. And, you know, being in the family of an elected official, we have lots of conversations in our household. We had some interesting conversations after a rock came through my window. So, you know, and I guess I mentioned that because it's the randomness of violence, the vulnerability. I mean, that was what I heard from my kids about then. So we talk about things, but I tend to let my kids raise them. I don't want to bring too much trauma into the household.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let me shift. These are issues that we're going to be taking up throughout the day, and you're going to be dealing with it. Have you had phone calls from people? I mean, I noticed, for example, that when you were acknowledging the Race to the Top money, you told the city, your statement was, you know, we're here to help the city of Seattle and the school district in many right. ways. City of Seattle helps with the school levy and other issues. You're ready to help with that. Conversations about school security and school safety have been popping up in the last few days, too.
You know, so what we do is as soon as we heard about the school shooting in Newton, in fact, it's happened in the police department, we had officers out and visibly present around schools, primarily as reassurance, but also because it can be a deterrent and just make people feel safe. I heard from parents, you know, who just immediately went and got their kids out of school. And it's probably as much about giving their kids a hug as it was about
sure.
keeping them safe. And I understand that impulse.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So we wanted to, you know, so that's what we do in these situations. And so that's ongoing right now. We do want to make sure that all of the parents and children and teachers and staff at the schools know that, you know, we're aware and that we'll be more present as that happens. But, of course, we can only do that for so long. And that's not going necessarily to prevent it. I mean, if you look at Newton, the shooter forced his way into the school.
Right.
It was not – there was not an open door.
Right, right. But, of course, we're just going to see – as you mentioned that statement about the shoe bomber, I imagine one of the responses we're going to see is more – even at elementary schools, more locks, more authorities, more –
You know,
whatever.
And this just keeps getting us back. I mean, that's I think we all understand that that's not ultimately the solution. The solution is around treatment for those with mental illnesses and changing our gun use culture in the country. And that's not the solution. You know, we were talking about this before we went on the air. This is not the solution that they choose in other places, other nations, which have much less gun violence than we do.
Let me ask, since folks called, let me take a couple of calls from folks, and I want to ask about that mental health question as well, but is it Yael?
That's right, Yael.
Yael.
Uh-huh.
In Olympia. You're looking at mental health funding.
Well, yes. I started working at County Mental Health in Olympia in 1978, and ever since then, funding has been cut. The reality is our streets are more dangerous because you have a lot of people with severe mental health issues homeless on the streets.
Well, so that I appreciate that call because it gets me to the question. I mean, this is the question the city has to deal with because, of course, those cuts don't mean that there aren't people needing services. It comes down to the city level. How do you feel about your mental health funding right now, what you can provide?
Well, you know, I'll just bring it right back to it. At the state level, they have, you know, they have continual funding issues. Right now, they have a Supreme Court order that they need to fund education. And I don't know what the number is, whether it's $1 billion or $1.5 billion. They have to find it. We also have a governor and a legislature saying no new taxes. Well, this is what happens. You know, we see the mental health funding get cut, and we see basic services get cut. We've been down in Olympia fighting to protect these services year after year, and we've protected them at the city level, but we don't have the resources to replace it locally either. And you can't. This is a systemic issue. It can't necessarily be solved at a city level, you know, dealing with mental health issues. It's meant to be dealt with at a higher level than that. We find ourselves in the position of, you know, our police officers dealing with these issues on the street. You know, we have a mental health professional on the staff of our police department. We now have all of our officers going through crisis intervention training so they can deal with folks that have mental illnesses on the street and figure out, you know, what's the safest way to deal with them. And, you know, but you can't arrest somebody for simply being unstable. They have to do something wrong first. So a lot of this ends up being pushed down to us as an enforcement issue as opposed to a prevention and treatment issue, which is, you know, a public health issue.
Didn't you move some monies around for some mental health? I should have checked, but I thought there were some.
I can't speak directly to mental health. We have moved money around to preserve services for homeless services. And we do, in fact, have, do extensive outreach to try to connect with people and get them off the street and connected to services. One of the biggest challenges we have is having services available to them if we reach them. Some folks are very hard to reach as well. So we have, I'd have to check the budget, but, you know, whatever changes we've made are, I mean, I just want to be really honest. We focus on this. Whatever changes we made are not to the scale of the problem. We don't have the resources to meet the scale of the problem. This is something about how we care for and treat individuals with mental health issues at a statewide level and beyond.
All right, one more call on this, and then I'll shift topics a little bit. But Loranne, Loranne, is that how I say it? Loranne in Seattle?
Lauren.
Lauren, I'm sorry. Lauren.
No, no problem.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm calling. I really want to put my money, little that it is, where my mouth is, and find some recommendations for helping the mentally ill and also fighting the NRA, because I'm still pretty upset.
Well, I don't know, but I know that in about an hour we'll ask some questions and of Tina Podladowski, former Seattle City Council member, who wrote an interesting crosscut arguing that it's time for an initiative in the state, since initiatives seem to work for other things. Maybe ask those who are willing to pay to try one more time to change the gun laws in this state anyway. It'd be an interesting question. I don't know about some of the charities.
You know, that, Lauren, that's a great question, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to and I'm sure my staff is listening. I hope my staff is listening, because I occasionally make commitments on the air. We're going to work on posting something today about what people can do to make a difference and not, you know, right away. Your question's a good one. And let me see if I can get my staff to work on coming up with an answer to that that we can share with the public.
And maybe we'll have some stuff in an hour from now. We're going to ask more folks to weigh in on what they're saying to their kids, but also the question of what you do next, how you would act, what you think should happen next. We'll take that up in 10 o'clock hour. Let me shift topics with the mayor a little bit. I have a question since you mentioned pot. So we hear that the president anyway says they're not going to go after these local pot laws. We still have to hear what the Justice Department says, right?
Well, I hope they take some direction from their boss on this one, because that's good news. You know, the turmoil over what law applies where, when, and how is really difficult. Now, I do feel compelled to say to people, you know, if you're anywhere, here's the deal. Here's the deal. State police, local police are going to follow state law. My understanding is, well, certainly in the city of Seattle will follow state law, which means if you have an ounce or less in your possession, you are not breaking any state law. You're not supposed to smoke it in public, and there's all sorts of other restrictions. And if you want to learn more about what the rules are, you can go to the SPD blotter and look up the Marrow What Now post, where there's a question and answer for people about what is or is not allowed under state law. Follow those laws. Don't show up to the federal courthouse, though. That would be my recommendation. I mean, the federal authorities still have the responsibility to enforce federal law, but they don't have the resources to enforce it statewide. And what we heard from President Obama is that presumably they are not going to use the power of the federal government to try to leverage the state out of its position, either the withholding of funds or a lawsuit or the like. So we'll just have to see how that develops. But I think it's good that, you know, Washington State's going to be given an opportunity to work on developing the regulations around the legal cultivation and sale and regulation and oversight of marijuana, and treat it in a much more sane and sensible way than we've been treating it. And that could be a model for the rest of the country if we do it right And I think it'd be a good thing if we can make sure we do it right.
Have you had any conversations with, or has your staff had any conversations with Washington State Liquor Control Board? Or have there been any invitations at this point to figure out the system that they're going to have to put into place within a year?
You know, I think there have been preliminary conversations, and I know the Liquor Control Board has a big piece of work, big body of work ahead of itself right now that it has to figure out how to organize to do the work, and I'm sure we're going to be asked to, cities will be asked to participate in that work. You know, I'll give you one small example. One of the issues is, I mentioned public consumption of marijuana. You're not supposed to do it in public. There's public, there's the issues about, do I have to be 25 feet from a doorway? Well, you can't be outside anyway. But, there are going to be issues about, I saw down in Olympia, one bar is opening a private smoking club in the upstairs. This is all uncharted regulatory territory. Even, what are the rules? What will be the fine for smoking in public? What will be the rules for that? So there's a lot of work to be done. And, we're going to want to participate in it, and over the next year, we're going to see those rules, rolling out over time, and there's going to have to be a lot of public education about that as well.
Well, and so Eric Holder, he was the one who said he would announce a policy on the new state laws relatively soon. So the president has sort of maybe laid a broad vision, but now Holder and the U.S. attorneys, our U.S. attorneys, Colorado's, they're going to have to tell us a little bit more about what they intend and what that means for state workers, for example, who are going to be dealing with these issues.
Sure. Now, no state worker's ever been prosecuted yet under a state medical marijuana law. And we've seen our local U.S. attorneys in the state take differing approaches to how to deal with medical marijuana dispensaries, legal under state law, but illegal under federal law. So, yeah, we're watching and waiting, but we hope they'll, show some respect for the voters of the state.
Coltrane's. There are big hearings on the Coltrane's. You do not want to see Coltrane's running through the waterfront in Seattle. But there is also a push to see those Coltrane's come through. And Puget Sound Energy has a coal-fired plant that it operates in Montana. So it's not as if coal is not part of people's energy portfolio, whether they like it or not. Are you maybe fighting maybe something that will change but isn't changing in the next few years?
Well, it has been changing. The reason they're selling it to China is because coal is not economically competitive in the United States the way it used to be. City of Seattle got out of its coal. We used to buy coal from the Centralia power plant, and we got out of it, and we've invested in conservation and wind power, and we have a portfolio of power, and we're set. I mean, there are days on windy days where we are spilling power from the wind turbines because there's no place for those electrons to go because we're conserving enough too at the same time. So we are in a good place on power right now, and we got off of coal. And what you're seeing is there was a coal rush nationwide a few years ago in which there were lots of coal plants on the drawing boards, and a lot of those have come off the drawing boards because they're not economical. There are other more efficient ways to meet our energy needs. So the coal companies have to sell their coal somewhere else. So their proposal is they're going to ship up to 18 trains a day, mile and a half long, moving slow through SoDo and our waterfront area, through communities across the state, spilling coal dust, polluting the water, clogging traffic, interfering with emergency vehicles, so that we can ship our pollution-causing coal over to China, where it'll come back to us in the form of mercury pollution and global warming. This is not a good economic strategy. It's forget environmental, forget health, forget social. It's a lousy economic strategy for us to take that many economic impacts locally so we can get more negative economic impacts so that coal companies can make a little money.
Well, or a lot of money. And there's a lot of money involved in this. And there are a lot of people who say this is about, let's not forget the jobs at the ports. Well, there's a big economic push against it.
Well, let's talk about this. This is a bulk, big volumes of dirty coal rolling through. 2% of their load is lost along the way. This is a topic I mentioned at the top of the hour. We're talking about investing in fiber optic cable to every home and business in the city.
Between you and me. Nobody else heard that.
Nobody else heard that.
We're going to take that up.
Yeah, right? And we are talking about building rail lines out to our neighborhoods, so you can get rail, so you can get out of congestion. You know, it's those are going to create jobs too, and make us more economically competitive. I think you may have seen an article today. Rahm Emanuel wants our bike lanes, our bikers, and our tech jobs, because he say they all go together. We have an economic strategy in this city in which we can take care of our basic infrastructure, like our seawall, where we can improve our transportation infrastructure with light rail, where we can improve our economic competitiveness with fiber optic cable. We can improve education. That's an economic development strategy which creates jobs, which helps the environment, which connects people to opportunity, which improves health. Shipping coal through us as an economic development strategy gets in the way of all that and makes us worse in all of the other categories as well. We have a choice, Steve. We have a choice, Steve, about what type of city and region we want to be.
Well, we may have a choice, or we may be feeling pressure from larger factors and larger forces. How likely do you think it is that whether it runs through Seattle or runs down to Longview or into Oregon or up to BC or different tracks over to Bellingham? I mean, how likely do you think it is
that we're going
to
see? I think Canada, you know, BC, Oregon, Washington State are all asking the same question. Are we prepared to burden ourselves economically with these coal trains for, you know, the positives that come with it? But the negatives far outweigh the positives for the state, you know, so that the coal companies can shift all the costs onto communities while they get the profits. You know, are we going to make that choice, or are we going to make a more sustainable economic and environmental and social choice? And what I'd go back to is, and this will test some people's memory, but it was when I was a young man, I went to work for a U.S. congressman. And at the time, the issue was nuclear power plants. And in the 1980s, it's absolutely inevitable that we had to build nuclear power plants. And the region went ahead with that, and it cost us a lot of money. Seattle actually said no, did not invest in the power plants that became WUPs. They ultimately collapsed under their own financial weight, you know, a tremendous cost. So it just didn't make sense economically to do it. But we had to go through a long period of time and waste a lot of money and create a lot of negative costs first. So we have things can seem inevitable because the powers that be want it. But people can speak up, and you can pick different choices. And by the way, we needed those power plants because everybody knew you could not have economic growth without creating more power plants. Well, it turns out we've had decades of economic growth with lower energy use per capita because energy efficiency is a better investment than new power plants. And that's going to be, and that's why we're shipping coal to China. It turns out that energy efficiency and alternatives are better investments for coal than coal in this country, and we need to hold the line on these coal trains. And if China's smart, they'll wake up to that fact too, and they'll figure out that there's no upside to importing tons of coal to pollute their air, degrade the health of their residents. You know, there are better ways to do it.
Oh, I hear all those coal seams just whispering to the people who want to make money on it. All right, let me take a break with the mayor and come back. Richard wants to remind us that it's 36 trains, of course, since they have to leave as well. So long trains going out as well will have some impact on traffic in Seattle. This is Weekday.
As we've been hearing earlier this hour, the Newtown Elementary School shooting has brought the issue of gun control to the forefront once again. So how has it changed your thinking on the issue? Ross Reynolds takes up the issue at noon today, takes your phone calls, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. Is the Newtown shooting a tipping point in the gun control debate? Call us right now, 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to protect the waters of Puget Sound and the native salmon and orca that live there. Earth Justice, the earth needs a good lawyer.
She held the side of the table with her hands. The whole town knows. Is that right? The only person who hasn't known is the old woman. You've all made a fool out of me.
Secrets and Lies. This week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
And that comes your way tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. We have cloudy skies and 44 degrees in Seattle. The National Weather Service has issued a high wind warning for much of western Washington until noon today. Forecast says clouds and rain, very windy, the high in the mid-40s. Chance of rain this evening, then a chance of snow overnight, the low in the low 30s.
Mike McGinn is the mayor of Seattle. He's in our studios, as he is once a month, to talk about some of the issues, take some of your calls. Actually, let me get Grant's phone call before I do then go to the question of Wired Seattle and South Lake Union. Grant's in the Central District. Hi, Grant.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Yep. Go ahead.
First of all, Mayor McGinn, I wanted to applaud your position on the coal trains and on our energy future in general. But one thing I wanted to comment on is it seems that in your statements or in your comments that you glossed over a little bit Seattle Public Utilities or Puget Sound Energy, rather, the fact that they have a giant coal plant in Montana, and the region does get not a majority, but a significant amount of its electricity from that coal plant.
Yeah, so I'll speak to that quickly. Puget Sound Energy is not the electricity supplier in the city of Seattle. It's Seattle City Light. So, but you are right. Puget Sound Energy does get power from a coal plant. And, you know, it's one of the things I'm proud of Seattle about. Our publicly owned utility has gotten out of coal. And we have in the state of Washington a requirement that passed by initiative by the people because the legislature wouldn't do it, a requirement that a certain portion of new power added by utilities has to come from renewable sources. But ultimately, that's a privately owned utility, and it would take some pressure for them to get off of coal. I think they should do it, personally, because of the pollution aspects of it.
Yeah. Does that address the issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank
you. Grant, thank you. All right, let me ask you about the ultra-fast broadband network that is planned for development. City of Seattle, University of Washington, a company called Gigabit Squared, announced plans to develop an ultra-fast broadband network. How much will it cost taxpayers?
This will cost the taxpayers basically nothing. What we are going to do is we are taking our dark fiber. We have fiber optic cable connecting government facilities across the city, so that gives us a backbone or a network backbone. What we are doing is leasing our unused fiber so that we'll recover the costs of laying the fiber from Gigabit Squared, and they will string fiber optic cable through the neighborhoods, and homes can then sign up for a fee to get potentially up to 1 gigabit of speed, which is about 1,000 times faster than most people are getting right now.
So do they get fiber in that last mile, as people put it?
Yeah, the last foot, you know. So what we've done is we've looked at 12 neighborhoods in which we're making our dark fiber available for them to build a network. So we passed this through the council, legislation allowing us to lease dark fiber. We put out a request for proposals. We've entered into a memorandum of understanding with Gigabit Squared. They have to go out to the private sector, raise money. They have to raise the capital to do their half of the deal. And then again, there's no city dollars. There's no city risk. But we are going to introduce choice into the marketplace. Instead of relying on copper cables from your cable company or your telephone company, you know, which is designed to carry voice or cable, not data, we're going to work to have a private company bring you a data network, which will be give you choice and give you options.
But it used to be I could get onto some free wireless around the U District and some other places. That was shut down. It wasn't working.
Sure.
Why didn't it work, and when does that occur?
Very, very different. That wireless was, about 10 years ago when Wi-Fi was first established. It was all the rage. And cities were looking at creating free Wi-Fi networks around the city. But, as you know, Wi-Fi speeds aren't that fast, number one. Number two, the private sector jumped in. You can get free Wi-Fi in coffee shops all around Seattle right now or supply your own. And so that just wasn't a place for the city to be spending money to maintain what is basically a lower quality, you know, system. We were spending money without that much benefit. Private marketplace was taking care of that. What we aren't getting is our cable company and our telephone company. You know, they built out a system that reaches every home, financially reach every home. You can pay a fee to reach them. They have no incentive under their duopoly system to upgrade their system to get substantially higher speeds. And so we're stagnating. Other cities, other countries are building these super fast networks, and we are falling behind. Ed Lazowski at the UW spoke eloquently to that at our press conference. So by putting our dark fiber up for lease, we're bringing a new competitor into the marketplace who is going to, you know, work to spring fiber optic cable through these 12 selected neighborhoods. In addition, they're also going to create point-to-point radio networks, which can also go up to 1 gigabit speed, and those will cover more than the 12 neighborhoods. So if you've got a radio transmitter, if you have a line of sight to one of these transmitters and you own a building or a home, presumably, you could connect up to that. So our goal is to have internet infrastructure that's up to the quality of our entrepreneurs and up to the quality of our people here.
What did it cost, $50 million to initially lay that fiber a few years back? Is that the money you're hoping to recoup?
Well, a fair portion of it, our pro rata portion. We're not doing this as a profit-making venture. You know, we're not trying to lease our fiber for everything the market will bear. We're trying to get cost recovery. And we laid that fiber for our own purposes, you know, for the purposes of City Light and Seattle Public Utilities and our library system and all of the things that city government does. When we laid it, we actually had a prohibition against any commercial use. And we had to change that by passing a different law through city council and as well as making it available to lease. We laid far more fiber than we needed. We have a lot of excess fiber. We're leasing that excess fiber to bring bring competition and choice to the marketplace, which will be good for the people of Seattle.
All right, one more issue before we turn it. Just before the end of the hour, we're going to talk to some folks about some of the – so we're talking to charities all week and next week too, just for people who are interested in giving monies to different places. So help for the holidays coming up. But first, all right, you're in the midst of your South Lake Union question. You say they're not big blocky towers down there at that's at 10. Oh, so I have more time with you. I don't have to. We won't be talking to the helpy.
Come on, let's go, Steve.
You
let's
say
take
it's
a
they're
few
not
minutes and
you're
chat.
Not they're not going to be big blocky towers. But boy, I stand down there at that new state of the art Mohai, and I look at that Mercer corridor that you've built, and it's empty now. There's going to be three towers on those blocks, big block square.
No, well, they're not going to be the size. Those towers are not the size of a square block.
No, big block square bases and then these towers. And Peter Steinbrück, your good friend, says, look, they're blocky. They're going to be big. They're not the skinny towers of Vancouver you talked about.
Well, first of all, Peter Steinbrück is a lobbyist for somebody working to protect their views. So, you know, let's just start there. There's a lobbyist.
Well, you know they said they weren't protecting their views, those folks in city council.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough, and they live there, and they care about their neighborhood, and they've come down to council, and they're talking, and it's great. People should contribute, but Peter Steinbrück is a lobbyist working for them. That's absolute fact. So here's the deal: we have the opportunity here in South Lake Union to continue to provide more opportunities for people to live there, and we've already creating thousands of jobs there, and this year's budget, as you may know, was a budget in which we didn't have to keep making deep cuts. We actually were starting to make investments in our city. We were able to expand the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. We were able to bring the police force back to the same level it was. We're rebuilding our rainy day fund to levels that were before the Great Recession hit.
This is all good, but in my 4 minutes
but
left, get to my blocky towers.
I'm going to get to your point. Development in South Lake Union's part of that. You want people in that park, we have to create residences near the park. And what we're doing is we're going to have one tower per block, which is lower in scale. The current height is 160. We can see going to 240 if we get more public benefits. all those investments in new development in South Lake Union, whether they're on the waterfront blocks or all through South Lake Union, means that people have to make more investments in affordable housing. We're going to get up to $45 million in affordable housing revenue from new development in South Lake Union. We're going to preserve rural land. We're going to create jobs. We're going to create housing. And we're going to keep doing the things that means that Seattle's doing well economically. Now, you know, we've sent that down to council, and council can, you know, they'll hear from the public. Should it be this height or that height? But here's what people should know on those blocks. If they're short buildings, you know, we can make short blocky buildings like we do right now in South Lake Union. They will almost definitely be office buildings then, because that's what the economics would dictate. If we allow for residential towers, which will be more narrow than are allowed elsewhere, and fewer towers per block, what it means is we will bring people there, which will be good for public safety, good for public vitality, good for activating the park. And it's the right thing to do as our city continues to grow, is to provide housing opportunities in the core.
All right. So what do you think of the argument about Kenmore Air and the other companies that aren't going to be able to land their planes there?
That's not so. We worked with Kenmore Air, the FAA. There is a very defined flight path, and that flight path is preserved. Nobody can build within the flight path.
The argument that says bust up those bases so that it's not all one block, one building per block, and then with the building code, and then make those towers skinnier and maybe not as tall.
Good argument on the busting up the bases. And in fact, to a great degree, we have. We're trying to get more mid-block pedestrian corridors through those blocks. And those are the types of things you can get as part of your development of the projects. As to the height, again, the height steps down from the center city down towards the waterfront. It's the same step down we have for going down to the waterfront on the in downtown.
But then it jumps up at the waterfront.
No, the 160 is the step down. But we would consider going from 160 to 240 at a next phase if...
Next phase.
Well, you'd need a development agreement, right? So we're going to leave the option open to go higher if the property owner puts even more money into housing and other public amenities. And that's a trade-off that we can choose whether we want to make or not.
But not necessarily in that neighborhood, yes?
The amenities would be in that neighborhood. That's what we've been talking to them about, the trade-offs. So the base level zoning would move up to 160 feet. If they wanted to go to 240, it would require council approval of a subsequent development agreement in which we would have to get an appropriate amount of public benefits in exchange. And it's just a trade-off. You know, Steve, I've been working really hard to bring investments to Seattle without taxpayer dollars. That broadband I spoke about. Sonics Arena, we spoke about that. You know, we have zoning.
We didn't even get to the Mariners' complaints on that.
Yeah, but we're getting private investment. Broadband, Sonics Arena, Amazon's going to build us a cycle track and buy us a new streetcar. What we're doing here is we're using private investment to invest in the public realm, and the public will have to make the decision about what the right trade-off is. But the smaller we make those buildings, you know, and they shouldn't be too big. They should be just right, and we'll argue about what just right is. But part of just right means that we get more dollars for affordable housing, for streetscape improvements, and for other public amenities. And, you know, I as well as creating jobs and housing in the city, which supports our entire city budget. So there are trade-offs to be had here.
All right.
And we'll argue about where the right trade-off point is, Steve, but it's a good argument to have.
Before we get to our porridge, one last quick one. I looked at the Seattle Times images of what those sizes of those buildings would be. And you also saw in that image Vulcan looking like they could build two towers on the site where they now have their, sort of exhibition hall that Vulcan has.
Yeah. So,
and there's a basketball court in a park there that is also private that they built. And then there's Denny Park.
Right.
Where is the park in the center of that neighborhood? You know, well, originally that neighborhood was going to have a big old park.
We got Denny Park, we have Cascade Park, we have South Lake Union Park, and when we build new connections across Aurora Ave, we'll have Seattle Center as well. Our issue there isn't that whether we have parks or not. The question there is whether we have parks that are really good and activated and well used and safe and comfortable. South Lake Union Park, Denny Park are underused facilities, frankly.
Maybe they need to be bigger.
Cascade Park is great. Hey, let's make the parks we have deliver on what they can deliver before we spend more public money on new parks.
All right. First of all, happy birthday.
Thank you, man.
And secondly, are you going to run for mayor?
All signs point to yes, Steve. And I'm going to sit down and talk with the family over the holidays and just confirm everybody is in a good space. And then look forward to some announcement in January, Steve.
All right. Thank you. We will see you in January.
Yes.
Happy holidays, Steve.
Thank you.
And happy birthday. Mike McGinn is the mayor of Seattle. Weekday continues. Stay with us.
It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.